Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Welcome, light workers, light body energies, seekers of the light, watchers, wardens, indigos, soothsayers, mystics, questers and querents, journeymen and journeyers, seekers, star children and philosophers, and all of those who are seeking reason and magic in these times of awakening, evolution, and transformation. I'm Barb DeLong, your host, and along with Nick Rossler tonight, I invite you to come in out of the mainstream and gather around my nightlight in the darkness and confusion of the times. The show represents a sort of pit stop on your cosmic journey, so sit back, share your light with other light-minded people, gather for a time and be sheltered from the storms of evolution and change. This is my own very small oasis in the turmoil that we call creation. Share with us your light. We'll share ours with you, and with any luck, we can generate enough light to not only light our ways, but provide light enough for others who are seeking as well. These journeys that we're on began a very long time ago and will continue long after this lifetime has faded into memory. So gathering together, as we do every week, generates energy that can and is drawn on by countless others. Coming together and blending our lights creates energy that serves not only ourselves, but humanity as well. As you know, this evening, Wednesday nights, is my time to get to talk to people who are in the same field or fringily the same field that I'm in and sort of compare notes and pump them for information and sort of delve into their investigations into the different areas that are out there that are not the normal realms. And tonight, I have a very special man on with me. His name is Nick Rossler. And among other things, he has written an amazing book called In Focus. And it documents a lot of the authenticated UFO sightings that have taken place in the United States. I think it's just the United States, but we'll have to ask him when I pull him on. His book is a profound book. It's very different in that it is reporting things from a more forensic point of view so that you don't get some of the hysteria, some of the craziness that often can circle around UFO sightings, because frankly they can be upsetting and unsettling if you're not used to them. I saw one when I was in college and took an amazing amount of teasing and kidding for years, for decades actually, until Nick's book came out, and happily my sighting was one of those that he reported on. So it validated something that I said and saw, my goodness, 40 years ago. So he has had a profound impact on lots and lots of lives, many of whom he probably doesn't even realize he has touched. I'm going to bring him on now. Hi, Nick. How are you doing tonight?
I'm good, Barb. How are you, dear?
I am fine. I want to thank you for rushing home so that you could do this show a little bit earlier tonight.
Well, hey, you know, it's, I'm happy to do it, and you know, like I say, I'm just that you would have me. So, hopefully we go.
You are absolutely one of my favorite authors, and that's because of your book, because it validated something that happened to me, and probably what happened to me happens to a lot of people. At least back in the 60s is what happened. Not so much today, because today when people see UFOs, they see UFOs, and they're very comfortable with the fact that there are UFOs out there these days.
I can't speak to that. I mean, some people are certainly comfortable with it. Having seen what I saw, I certainly wasn't comfortable with it, and You become comfortable with it, and the only remotely similar analog I can give you is kind of like what happened September 11th of 01, or you know, or something, the Kennedy assassination, something
yeah.
like that, where one minute your normal is one thing, the next minute you have a completely new normal and you just adjust to it.
Exactly.
I mean, I hate to put things in those blunt and stark of terms, but it's what it is. It's just adjusting to a new normal.
A new reality. And
exactly.
And I think what one of the things that I'm finding is that more and more and more we're getting reports on. I think that one of the things that upsets me so much about UFOs and the fact of UFOs and the fact that we are not alone and that it is a common knowledge and everybody really does embrace it to one degree or another is the fact that governments seem to still be pretending they don't exist, which confuses me greatly. I know there was a study done a very long time ago, 30, 40 years ago, that said if humanity as a whole was faced with the fact that there are extraterrestrials out there, they wouldn't be able to handle it, and there would be chaos and rioting and all sorts of things. But that just isn't the case today. And I, the more I see, the more I read, the more I begin to realize that we are being shielded, and not for our protection, but for a manipulation, if you will.
That's, you know, I would agree with you with as far as the shielding kind of take on it. For what reason, I couldn't say. I would like to think to some degree for our own protection, but. And that's, you know, once you get into a whole lot of other topics. But what you mentioned, the And I believe the study you were referring to was the Robertson panel back
yes.
in 1953. And yes. The important thing to remember about that is, well, frankly, that was bankrolled by the Central Intelligence Agency. So, of course, they come to a certain number of conclusions right out of the gate. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, no, I just, it to me, and you see, of course, back in the 50s, that was almost before computers were a common piece of equipment in the home. And now that computers are, you know, everybody's got one just about, we're able to really look at some of the material that's out there, and it's staggering. The amount of
mm-hmm.
stuff that is available out there. I was reading today about all of the different astronauts that have reported that there were UFOs, that they saw things that they couldn't explain. That and it's a part of eminent domain right about now. And anybody
mm-hmm.
can look at all of this and say, wait a minute, something else is going on here.
Well, exactly, and especially the NASA astronauts, and I've written in the book, as you know, about at least one NASA case.
Yeah.
But you go through the list of some of the astronauts who were involved in sightings or involved in we're talking about in orbit. And it is... I mean, you named the names. Story Musgrave, for example. John Glenn was in orbit at one point. And I don't know if it was Glenn that saw something or another member of that crew. To my understanding, other members of the Apollo program, for example,
mm-hmm.
It's not a short list. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, just to give you Dr. Edgar Mitchell, to his credit, has spoken out loudly and long about this topic. So, you know, I'd encourage anybody with an interest specifically in the space program, look into what has been saying.
Well, yeah, and I read one report today that spoke about the fact that the astronauts had been told to keep quiet, and
mm-hmm.
those that did not were involved in fatal accidents. And, you know, you hate to think your government would do that. But I'm beginning
exactly.
to think our government will.
I believe that of, especially when you look into some of the tangential things, especially at the birth of the space program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, John Kennedy said, you know, the moon at the end of this decade, and, you know, we'll do the hard, you know, the choice is not, but Kennedy never saw his to
No, he didn't.
It's really, it's But, and especially at what cost the United States government specifically, financially and otherwise, went to put people on the moon to explore space that
well,
we haven't necessarily gone back, I think, for me, it's a problem.
Well, there have been a lot of reports, and more so in recent days, that it's very fascinating that for instance, the Hubble telescope is not able to photograph the dark side of the moon. And the dark side of the moon is where it is said there are communities that aliens are there, that other countries are there, that there are people living up there. And I don't know just how far to go with the believability thing, but I find it very fascinating that there are blackouts and there are periods of time where astronauts have been silenced and you don't know why. And come on, there can't be that many national secrets that they could give away when they're out in space, for heaven's sakes.
You would think not. I mean, I can see both sides of the dark side of the moon argument. And, you know, I can understand from a science point of view why we don't necessarily, you know, point the Hubble telescope or some other piece of scientific equipment at the dark side of the moon or investigate it. Because the dark side of the moon is dark because it's away from the sun, and therefore, presumably,
Nick, we're losing you. You're fading in and you're fading out. You want to hang up and call back in, and we'll see if we can get a better connection.
Let me try. I'll give you a ring back in just a moment.
Okay, though. Great.
All right.
Nick has so much wonderful stuff to share. I don't want you guys to miss any of it because he's probably one of the most brilliant men I've ever met. And he can't be swayed. You know, he's not gonna go off on a half-cocked idea or anything. And of course, I will. I'll do that in a heartbeat. But there are so many things that I want to ask him about tonight, and it would be a shame if we lost some of him. Hi, are you back?
I'm back.
You're back much better. Great.
Okay.
You
don't really know what happened there, but
a forbidden topic. Yeah, I'm going to start in on another topic. What possessed you to write your book in the first place?
Sheer stupidity on some on some level. And I say that as you certainly take it completely tongue in cheek, because I say that because it was quite a bit of work and. Quite a bit of work that a lot of people wouldn't subject themselves to in their wildest imaginings. But, it was just, I was always drawn specifically to the older cases, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s on up.
Yeah.
And my professional background, you know, being criminal justice, the idea just popped into my head, present the best evidence that you possibly can, present the hard evidence that people can't readily explain away of, oh, this is a misidentification, this is a light in the sky, this is the planet Venus, and go from there.
Well, I think it was brilliant, and I think that you pulled so much of it together. I mean, you know, you have a couple of my most favorite sightings. You have the Battle of Los Angeles. You have the Phoenix lights and the Washington lights that just are undeniable.
Well, exactly. Washington National Airport is probably one of my personal favorite cases. Just for that very reason, that you cannot explain it away. But, you're always going to have you know, with detractors saying, well, it could have been this, it could have been that. In the case of the events over Washington in 1952, we're talking about two successive weekends and things violating, you know, military restricted airspace. Then, it was then, it is now. You know, I would challenge anybody to come up with a plausible explanation for the events of July of 52, you know, July 1920 and 26-27 of 52 without stretching the, let's say, the fabric of believability.
Well, they did try.
Well, I mean, you can try. You can also fail rather spectacularly while doing it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Now, I just think that the public getting stonewalled the way that we have been stonewalled for so very, very long is I think, it's fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's bordering on the criminal in a lot of respects, but after a while, it just becomes, you know, institutionalized, at least on the part of government, or at least this government.
Yeah,
because you have so many internationally that have been very open about what they know or what they've reports they've received, etc.
Well, you know, India, China, Mexico, you just about name it, and the countries are very open and forthcoming, and they've released their records, and people can go over them, and they can, you know, take what they want, and they can believe it or not, but there's not a big issue about it. And the only place that there's such cloak and dagger stuff going on here that it fascinates me is the United States.
There are a couple of others, but it is chiefly the United States. But yeah, I mean, you mention some of the other nations, and I want to, at least on that note, backtrack a couple of years. 2008, the Mutual UFO Network, through a colleague and good friend of mine, Ruben Uriarte, in Northern California, in San Jose, put on a wonderful symposium with nothing but international speakers, people from Mexico, from Chile, from Belgium, you name it. I mean, there are so many countries out there that have UFO data, UFO documentation, and these are people that are that have credentials that are beyond reproach. You can't argue with former fighter pilots, lieutenant colonels, who've subsequently retired as generals in some cases. You look around the world, countries that are releasing documents or at least speaking candidly about this topic. You said India, Belgium, Germany, France, the United Kingdom, Canada. It's phenomenal. I mean, some of the documentation on some of the specific cases in my book, I got by way of the Canadian government, and I was concerned about having to maneuver my way around the Canadian Access to Information Act, which is roughly analogous to what we have here in the States. But I went to Library and Archives Canada, and there was documentation right on their website, for heaven's sakes.
Wow.
So if that doesn't give you an idea of the openness and transparency that our friends to the north have versus what's presently being practiced in the United States, I don't know how much more clear we can make it.
Well, you know, I certainly have opinions as to what's going on to a certain degree. Do you have any, you know, do you have a theory as to why we are being held, you know, hostage to the truth?
Well, I think the simplest explanation, or at least prevailing opinion behind closed doors, probably is something akin to Jack Nicholson in the film A Few Good Men, that we in fact can't handle the truth. But you know, I think that's where a lot of this stuff, I think, is starting to tread on what I hope to do with my second book, which a number of other authors have done, you know, or have looked at similarly, is this whole secrecy issue and a number of other things. But I think for me, it really ties into the military-industrial complex, black budget projects, etc. I mean, I think, to be real frank about it, I think it kind of goes to something that was told to Woodward and Bernstein with regard to Watergate: follow the money.
Ah, yeah. I would agree on that. I just, and, you know, like I said when you were calling in, you know, I will go off half-cocked in a heartbeat. You won't. But I am getting the feeling that Now, I speak only as a psychic. Here, I don't talk as somebody who really has, you know, credible evidence for anything. But I get a strong feeling that there is something in the wind that the government really has no control over, and I think the government is very frightened that at some point in time, We're going to all figure it out, and the government is going to have to explain why it lied to us.
Well, exactly. I think that's the $64 trillion question, and I think that's kind of the point where a number of friends and colleagues of mine have been kind of slowly marching this long slog to try to get some answers. People like Steve Bassett and Richard Dolan, who I not only consider, you know, great researchers, but also dear friends. But I mean, you know, I think I don't necessarily say unfortunately, but one way or the other, I think that's what you get when you deal in this subject. You get interested, and like I've said to a number of other people, you start with an interest, and you read a book or you read two books, and you watch a documentary or two, and it goes from being your interest to being your obsession to being just your unabiding passion. Because speaking personally, that's what it's been, because it builds and builds and builds, and you read one or two books and you read a couple of journal articles and you read a couple of scholarly papers by certain researchers, and you just come away with the inescapable conclusion that there's really no argument on the other side. There's just no differing opinion, because there's just nothing that will hold up to that degree of scrutiny.
Well, I think what's coming, and again, I am not an expert, but it's just a feeling that I have, is that you know, now when something doesn't work, one administration will blame it on another administration and stuff like that. From what I can feel, there won't be any administration that anybody can go at and say, you know, it's their fault, because it's all of their faults for perpetrating this incredible lie that we've been fed and fed consistently for at least the last 50 years, if not longer.
Oh, right, exactly. I will agree with you 99.5%. I will say you can point the finger at one administration. I'd say if you want to point the finger at somebody, point the finger at President Truman.
Okay.
Because that's, for basis of argument, that's where this all started. You know,
oh.
19...
Well, then how do you... What year?
47.
Roswell.
Yeah, even predating Roswell. But yes, let's for the sake of the general public, start with July of 47, with the incident at Roswell. I mean, that's where this started. The wire service, yes, you know, down flying saucer on a ranch outside of New Mexico. Very next day, oops, it was a weather balloon.
Yeah, right.
No, it doesn't. I'm sorry, it doesn't track.
No, it doesn't.
And they
really thought we bought it.
And to throw out there various military personnel, specifically then Major Jesse Marcel. And essentially brand him however you will, by, you know, essentially ordering him to take these ridiculous photos with material that is a weather balloon, when we find out subsequent to this, you know, that this is most certainly not the material he saw or handled, and this is just damage control.
No.
I'm sorry, it did.
Yeah, no,
it's
ridiculous, because they have a picture of him holding his instructions, and because of, you know, wonderful camera work and stuff like that, we're able to actually read a great deal of what it is that is said on that piece of paper in his hand, and mm-hmm. basically it's telling him to lie.
Well, right, and I go into this, you know, as you know, in the book. And that was my whole purpose for including the Roswell incident in the book, is because of these photos that were shot in Fort Worth, Texas, and then, you know, subsequently computer technology becoming what it became. You have people involved with the Mutual UFO Network and, you know, other professional groups that were able to enlarge these photographs and, you know, digitally clean them up to a point where you can read a very good portion of the memo that's in Roger Ramey's hand in this photograph. And if you look at the original photograph, it's an absolute miracle any of it's readable at all.
Oh, yeah, it is amazing what technology can do. But I just, you know, after look, it's almost 60 years since that happened. 60, 70. It's a very long time.
Yep.
And
yeah.
And that they haven't broken down and said, yeah, a UFO crashed. We have it, you know, we retro-engineered a lot of things from it. We've gained a lot of information from it. Frankly, some of the material that is now floating out there is just so amazing that you know, you sit back and you think, how dumb do they think we are?
Well, exactly, and I mean, this is a topic that I've tossed around with a number of researchers, not necessarily directly with regard to the UFO topic, but also on a more governmental level. Our friend John Nowinski, Richard Dolan, for example,
uh-huh.
And you delve into this world of, you know, black budget projects and a military budget, for example, that nobody has figures on, but the military hardware, the weaponry, the aircraft, etc., that we have out available to the public, that the public is cognizant of now.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told a good rule of thumb is to say that is at least 20 years behind what exists behind closed doors at a facility such as Groom Lake, Nevada, more commonly known as Area 51.
Right.
I mean, the military-industrial complex, being what it is, and President Eisenhower warned the country about it in his farewell address to the nation.
Yes, he did.
Eisenhower could, you know, even then, you know, see some of these things coming. To me, I think what's out there now that the public is aware of, taking that 20-year figure to mind and, you know, extrapolating that out as to what possibly exists behind closed doors that the public isn't aware of,
mm-hmm.
Is utterly terrifying. I mentioned to someone about a week and a half ago that for all real intents and purposes, this is like, quite frankly, it's like a bad science fiction movie. It's like watching James Cameron's original Terminator, with one caveat. I mean, now it basically is, we've become Skynet.
Yeah, we have.
It's not a matter of man versus machine. We've become it.
I'd have to go along with you on that. And you know, I'm horrified. I my philosophy as to where humanity should go and is going and all of that is just, it's so not what apparently seems to be on track for all of us that it's like, you know, there are moments I sit back and I think, am I wrong? And I keep getting the message that, no, you're not wrong. It's just that for some reason, I mean, we have become the warmongers. We have become the empire builders. We have become the spider web that chokes the life out of individuality. And I don't understand how that happened.
You know, I think, what's the phrase? The road to hell is paved with good intentions?
Yeah.
I think that's how it happened. For want of a For one of a better, you know, I think that's how it happened.
Well, you know, we tried to save the world from communism, and you know, that was at least, you know, the war cry, the battle cry, and the reason that supposedly we did a lot of things. And it's no longer a threat, and yet we seem to be, I think Patrick once spoke about the fact that we had missiles pointed at places where in the 1940s there was something there, but there's not there, and there's nothing there anymore, and we still have our missiles pointed there. I mean...
Unbelievable.
I mean, something is... Go ahead.
Right, and you hit on something that I intend to cover in the new book that I'm trying to sort of cobble together from all sorts of different sources, because I am going to look into this whole process, if you will, UFO secrecy, you know, government black projects, and the eventual disclosure, because there is a point by which you have to reach something akin to critical mass, and you just have to give up the ghost, because it's just not, you can't contain it any longer.
Well, I would hope that that time is coming soon, because, I spoke earlier about the fact that, you know, I saw a UFO and I was, you know, really verbally beaten up for it because I had drunk too many beers or something. And you know, 40 years later, you write a book that proves to everybody that I didn't drink too much. And, you know, these days, they're just telling us, never mind, you don't, you know, you, it's on a need to know basis, and you don't need to know. And,
right.
And you know,
it's the Wizard of Oz. It's pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do that there's just so much information out there, and it travels so fast that
right.
I understand their need to not put everything out there. But
to a point that's a fair argument, but then again, you're also tiptoeing a very, very, very fine line.
Well, look at the first war we had, you know, where everybody, even the enemy, was getting this information from CNN. Now that's scary.
Right. Right, but I mean, you know, like I said, I'm looking at in putting together the new book. I'm looking at, you know, where some of these things started, and the thing for me that scares me the most.
Yeah.
Are events that even precede the Roswell event and continue well beyond that. I don't know, are you at all familiar with what the military referred to as Operation Paperclip?
No, I'm not.
That was one of our you know, more shining moments as a country. It was quite frankly, I think it was a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of a scenario. But that's where the military and the intelligence community specifically helped shuttle a number of. Originally, it was always supposed to be former Nazi scientists out of Third Reich, out of Germany. So, long story short, some of these people do not face war crimes trials. They come to the States. Some of them go to Britain. A handful end up in Russia. But,
well, wait a minute. Isn't that where our nuclear program came from?
A good portion of it. A lot of our space program was born out of it as well.
Wernher von Braun. I mean, he was one of the ones.
Exactly, von Braun specifically. And I was having this argument, or I don't want to say argument, but I was discussing this with somebody today, as a matter of fact, that, okay, the war ends in 45. I can see the feasibility of an argument that we do this to win the space race. We do this to, you know, jumpstart our nuclear program, etc. I can see keeping this program in place, let's say, to the mid-50s, to 1960, if you want to feel generous about it. My problem is it does not stop there. It does not stop for a very, very, very long time. The last documented individual that enters the United States via Operation Paperclip that I'm aware of entered the United States via a number of South American countries. You know, the ones that were sympathetic to Germany during the war, through
mm-hmm.
Texas into the United States, to my understanding, as late as 1991. That I have a fundamental problem with.
Well, our government has been covering up since the 1800s. Are you aware of what they did with the giants, the bones of the giants that they found when they were settling the West?
I've heard of that. I haven't really delved into it for any number of times. I'm feeling familiar with it.
Patrick did delve because, of course, he...
Which would surprise me.
He delved a lot. Yes, he did. but he looked into the fact that the army was basically killing everything that came in their way, and unfortunately there were tribes of giants, literally tribes of giants, double rows of teeth, six digits on each, you know, fingers and toes. I mean, giants, real live giants, fought with the Indians. And when they were killed, they were unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know which, they were white-skinned. And the government didn't want anybody to know that they were killing white people. So the government was instructed to send all the bodies back to the Smithsonian, which they did. And the Smithsonian has all of the bodies hidden in their vaults that nobody will ever see. But it's hundreds and hundreds of bones of giants. And the Smithsonian has got them all tucked away very nicely so that none of us ever see them.
Well,
I have that documentation if you want it sometime.
It would certainly make interesting bedtime reading.
Well, you know, the element of a giant is something that you know, it was reality. There were giants, and so you know, I mean, and what's fascinating is one lady did actually even contact us, and she said she was pretty sure she was related to one of the tribes, and she proceeded to give us her, you know, the physical recounting of what her reason for explaining or why she felt this was the case. And, you know, it was amazing. You know, she was absolutely, she had the six digits. She had, I mean, everything that one would need to actually say, yes, you do come from a tribe of giants was right there. And there was no denying it. And, you know, you get stuff like that going on all the time here. So,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I didn't mean to, you know, jump ahead with giants, but the government has, you know, they keep things secret when they think that they know better. They never even think that, you know, we might be able to handle whatever it is they're trying to cover up, that maybe cover up isn't the best way to go. Maybe, you know, giving us the facts so we could make intelligent choices and decisions on our own seems a very smart, a much smarter thing to do.
Well, certainly. But, I mean, you know, just in looking at some of the material that I hope to put together into, you know, a new UFO-related book. I mean, I, like I said, I'm looking into it much like a number of other writers. You know, I'm looking at it from nonfiction. You know, show me the documents. You know, provide me with the provenance. You know, give me the hard facts. You know, I'm not interested necessarily in, you know, in
sensationalism.
The realm of the fantastic, so much as, well, I mean, you're going to get there. I mean, you're invariably going to get there anyway.
Absolutely.
Just by nature of this subject, but, you know, give me the documents, show me the reasons why this is so, and if somebody wants to argue the case, you know, I will or Richard Dolan or any of these other hardcore serious researchers out there who put in numbers, you know, innumerable years or hours of research on any particular individual case, you know, you will find yourself painted into a corner where you don't have another option.
Well, I think what's frightening is, you know, we are led to believe that there is free access to information and stuff like that. And yet when you have the Freedom of Information Act that holds back so much stuff from you, you do begin to wonder, and you know, it's kind of like
I can give you a real interesting, for instance, right on that very point.
Okay.
I did a couple of very cursory Freedom of Information requests in the recent past. For the new book, specifically, I requested my own FBI file, which I know exists because I needed to do certain things by virtue of my day-to-day employment that would have gone to that level.
Okay.
So I in fact know they have a file on me. I got back this very cursory response of it's a standard response from the FBI, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation is not in the habit of maintaining files on private citizens, yada, 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 et cetera, et cetera. I can tell you I don't necessarily believe that where it involves people such as myself, people within the UFO research community, because because it just doesn't hold water. To give you a for instance, there was a prominent UFO researcher who came here to Milwaukee in the last year. This is somebody who travels extensively. So certainly, you know, he would know how to get through airport security with books or with whatever it is that one needs to travel with when this is what you do.
Okay.
I picked him up at the airport. His books and such come through the, you know, the luggage carousel. Tape's been flashed open. His books have been rifled through, et cetera, et cetera. And he says to me something along the lines of, why does this keep happening to me? This happens to me every city I fly into. My luggage has been rerouted to cities I don't even live in,
wow.
Cities I haven't traveled through. He lives, let's just say, within the Eastern time zone.
Yeah.
He said his luggage has gotten rerouted through Washington Dulles when he lives several hundred miles from there.
Amazing.
He doesn't. So as a for instance, I know for a fact that the various three-letter agencies have kept tabs on UFO researchers going back to the 50s. So why stop now?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm fairly certain, and this is just speaking personally, I'm fairly certain that with some of the company I keep within this field, I would be not only incredibly surprised, but I would be incredibly disappointed if you didn't keep tabs on me, given some of the company I keep. But
and you know, it's just. It makes you wonder why they are putting us under the microscope when really they can't even survive a cursory investigation into their offices and what they're doing. I mean, our government is not the government that we are led to believe it is, and that's frightening.
Oh, most definitely. I know that President Carter ordered members of the intelligence community to release various documents in attempting to fulfill a campaign promise in the early 70s. And to my understanding, he was told you don't have the authority to do that, Mr. President.
Yeah. And what about, wasn't it Bill Clinton that asked about stuff and he was told it was all he needed to know and he didn't need to know?
Yeah, that was Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton and John Podesta, as well, his chief of staff, I believe, at the time, pushed at the president's direction. Of course, pushed for various agencies to release documents. And Bill Clinton, from what I've been told, made no bones about going to the directorship of some of these agencies, specifically the FBI, and very pointedly saying, I want to know what happened at Roswell, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know Excuse me.
Yeah.
I want to know what happened in New Mexico in 47. I want to know this. I want to know this. I want to know this. And he was essentially Stonewall.
Well, what can... Yeah, all right. What can the president do? I mean, you know, you would think he's supposed to be, you know, the final word. And if he's not the final word, who the heck is?
Well, again, exactly. That's the $64 trillion question, isn't it?
Well, who is really running the government? I mean, we like to think the president has the final say, the final veto, the final whatever. But that's not the case, apparently, and I'd like to know who it is that really has.
Well, exactly. If you as hypothetically say the director of the CIA, for example, stand there toe-to-toe with the President of the United States in the Oval Office, which, you know, some people have said is the greatest home court advantage in the entire free world. I mean, I don't understand how you can stand there toe-to-toe with the President of the United States, your feet on the great seal on the rug, and say, quite frankly, Mr. President, you're not qualified to ask for that information. I don't understand that.
No, that is, isn't that bizarre? I mean, when you stop to think about it, it's on a need to know. Need to know.
Well, if it were me, and let's just use President Carter as an example, because he made a point of saying he would do this were he elected president.
Mm-hmm.
Much like now, any cabinet official, any head of any major agency, to my understanding, submits an undated signed letter of resignation to the White House. I would have expected the President of the United States to say, well, I expect your letter of resignation on my desk in the morning. I don't understand why it gets to that point that we've got continuing secrecy going on when, you know, the 900-pound gorilla in the room says exactly the opposite.
Well, let me ask you something, because I'm not as up to date on political stuff as you are. If somebody looked at the president and said it's on a need to know basis and you don't need to know, sir, who appointed that man to office?
That's a very good question.
And if indeed he has the authority to fire that man, who appoints his successor?
I would imagine the President of the United States. But again, you're going in circles here, because I know it becomes sort of mind-boggling in that regard.
I mean, if it were just a case of you're fired. And hey, Charlie, you're going to be the new director here, and I want to know about the UFO stuff. And Charlie gets he gets approved, he gets vetted, he gets put in office, and everything's fine. And the president then says, okay, Charlie, tell me about the UFOs. And he says, Mr. President, it's on a need-to-know basis, and you don't need to know. What the hell is going on?
Well, right. You know, it's then the tail is wagging the dog. It's astounding. And just to give you a for instance, amongst my research material for the new book is the report that the U.S. Air Force put out on Roswell back in 97. And, you know, this is printed by the United States Government Printing Office. It was sold in bookstores of, to my understanding, every federal building in the country. The cover price on that book is in excess of $50. You know, you're talking a $50 to $60 book printed at taxpayer expense. There's not one fact in the book outside of, you know, people's names and ranks and so on. When it's becoming a misuse of taxpayer funds, and you don't have more than a handful of facts in that book, then you know, aren't you by definition withholding something?
Well, absolutely, and they're baffling us with paperwork.
And the Air Force, to my the best of my recollection, they've released or are releasing updates to this report on a, you know, semi-regular basis. They've officially changed the story so far as from the Air Force's point of view, to my knowledge, 5 or 6 times. So how can the facts change so dramatically? Other than you're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole.
Well, I would imagine they keep changing the facts according to whatever material is out there at this moment in time.
Well, no, exactly. I mean, how do you, if the facts are the facts, and, you know, this event in New Mexico in 1947 was a non-issue, why the need to continually do damage control?
Well, it's you know, I mean, I don't know, you know, if you were perfect as a little kid. I was not. And every now and then, I would get caught in a lie. And in order to try to worm my way out of it instead of, you know, being honest.
Yeah,
I would, you know, take it even further. And you know, before you knew it, you had such an amazing story going on that it blew away your mind. But the reality is, you know, nobody could, you know, the lies just had compounded themselves to the point where it was impossible to really figure out what the truth was.
Well, right.
And I think that's what
right.
they're doing.
Well, I wouldn't doubt that, but I mean it's just becoming such a shell game that unless you know exactly where to look and whose research to trust, and I mean, it seems to me that unless everybody in this field becomes something of a scholar in this field in their own right, you don't have any sort of clear path as to what material to trust or what direction to go in. And I think that's kind of part of the overall picture. I think the whole plan is, let's spinning the wheels and see what happens here.
Well, then where does that leave people like you who are trying to uncover a level of truth? And you know, when do you know you actually have something that is valid or just a really, really good cover-up story?
Well, you know, that's a good question, but I would say that at least within this field, I've been very, very fortunate to have some of the contacts that I have.
Mm-hmm.
So in a lot of respects, I can go directly to the source and say specifically, just to go through, for an example, the chapter in my book that I did on the 1991 space shuttle discovery incident, STS-48, when there was video footage there, I went directly to the gentleman who originally investigated the case, Dr. Jack Kasher. I mean, the man is a now retired physics professor. He's had experience with the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. I mean, he's got an incredible resume. Just as an example, I went directly to him and said, Dr. Kasher, help me explain this for those of us in the community that are not physicists. You know, help me nail this down in as simple a language as is possible. You know, or there was a case I wrote about elsewhere in the book that took place in Canada, and interestingly enough, the gentleman who had a lot of the details and who was the major civilian researcher on that case also as a child had ties to the original witness. Canadian researcher by the name of Chris Rutkowski out of Winnipeg. And, you know, he and I have subsequently become very good friends. But, you know, I was able to, you know, send him a few emails or, you know, pick up the phone and call him and say, well, Chris, what can you tell me? You know, what have you got that that I can sort of run with? I've, you know, been able to really rely heavily on good contacts. But then, tangential to that, you know, then it's just good dogged investigative journalism. I went to the And by saying I went to, I mean I contacted the University of Arizona for some information, University of Texas, the Ford Presidential Library, for example. I mean, it's just a matter of slowly trying to piece things together and as logical
a
way as...
It's literally doing the legwork, isn't it?
Oh my God, yes. And I mean, just it's really astounding. I mean, the 230 some odd pages that comprise my book, which I know you've read
a number
rather
of times.
Lovely.
Yes.
You pick up that book and you've got 230 pages here, but you don't stop and think of the X amount of dollars that it cost to get this file or that file or pay to use these photographs or what have you. I probably At the height of when I was writing that book, I probably was doing, between my day job and writing the book, I was probably doing 20-hour work days.
Wow.
Yeah, but I mean, for me, that was fine because it's just a matter of getting into a routine, and you do it because you have to do it.
Well, but also, you did it because you loved it. I mean,
right.
I can totally relate to, you know, 20-hour work days and things like that. And you know, when those things happen, it's because there is, I would even call it a compulsion inside of you that you.
You have to say that within the most positive context possible. But yes, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, I can remember moments when my mother would say, "Aren't you ever going to go to bed?" And I would say, "Yeah, in just a few minutes." And then 4 hours later, it's like you know, and time flies. You fold time. It's exhilarating once you're committed and involved in a project like that.
Well, right, because you're just swallowed up in it.
Which is a good thing. So is that why you're doing another good book?
I suppose. I mean, it's partially it's to keep me busy. It's just partially because, well, quite frankly, I think there's a story to be told here, and you know, it's. I mean, I think there's a different there's a different story to tell, or at least a different facet of this story that you can tell.
Well, I totally agree with you, and it feels like I can understand where you're coming from, because I think that people who write are driven. And there becomes something inside of them that they need to bring out into the light and share with other people, and that just keeps at you until you actually do it. And you know, I don't think every author is like that. But when you're talking information, when you're talking getting a philosophy out there, I think that absolutely that's what happens.
Well, right, and. For me, anyway, I think it's weird because when I'm putting this together, ironically, the one book that I find myself going back to and flipping through and rereading at least passages of, just to kind of get some sort of a mindset and get some sort of a frame of reference on, has absolutely nothing to do with UFOs. and the book that I keep going back to is Woodward and Bernstein's All the President's Men.
Interesting.
Because... Stanton Friedman very astutely and for years has been using this phrase. He's been referring to the whole UFO subject as a cosmic Watergate. And I have to admit, I think Stan is right as far as that goes. But with this particular view that I'm taking, you know, on this new project, when you start dealing with secrecy and disclosure and, you know, black budget government projects that are covered up by their very nature, I mean, I think you get to a point where you're doing like Woodward and Bernstein did 40 years ago. And you know, you're speaking truth to power, and you're saying there's the official story, and then there's this. The scales aren't exactly balanced here.
Yeah, true.
And don't the people, capital T, capital P, who are paying your salaries, who are funding these projects with American tax dollars, for example, don't the rank and file, for want of a better phrase, deserve some answers? I mean, I think people in general deserve some answers and don't deserve a research facility out in the middle of the Nevada desert with a sign that says use of deadly force authorized.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you can keep secrets, but at what cost?
Well, and you know, I sometimes wonder, is there really a secret there? Or is that just a cover-up so that we aren't looking in the right place?
I think we're probably not looking in the right place, but I think you look there, and I think there's a piece there. I think where you need to be looking is somewhere else, but why is that necessarily surprising? You mean it's rule number one of magic tricks. Misdirection, you know, look over here while I'm doing something over here.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's very true. Very true. No, I sometimes, you know, it's sort of like they're making such a big deal of Area 51, and I'm just not sure there's anything there anymore.
Oh, I mean, there's things there, but...
Well, yeah, but not what I would...
But, I mean, there are things there. There are answers there, but there are answers there to questions we've already asked.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, there are answers there, and I mean, I don't think that hypothetically, if you threw open the doors to the test facility at Groom Lake, Area 51, it's not going to be like the movie Independence Day. I mean, it's going to be something along the lines of the stealth technology or these predator drones, or it's going to be military R&D type stuff.
Yeah,
it's going to be. For want of a better sort of analogy, it's going to be Tony Stark's workshop with the Iron Man suit. You know, it's going to be something with a practical military application, but it's not going to be bodies and UFOs with sand in the gears, and I mean, that's not what you're going to find there. But I think the key question you need to ask is, well, if you're building things like the Predator drone, if you're building things with stealth technology, where the hell did you get it from?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the major question that nobody's asking, because you're not, it's not so much that you have an organization or an entity that's withholding information. It's just you're not phrasing the question correctly.
Well, you know, you look at things like Velcro, you look at things like some of our computer technology and stuff like that, and you just know that it didn't come the way they say it did. My premise has always been and will continue to be until some UFO tells me otherwise, that our science fiction movies are a subtle way of exposing us to a technology that is coming that we will be very comfortable with and utilize, but it's somebody's idea as to how to get our consciousness ready to accept some of this strange stuff. I mean, when you look at the very early Star Treks, at the doors that opened and shut for them, you know, that sense they're coming in. I mean, you know, that happens all the time now. Their tricorders. Look at our cell phones. We're not even flipping them anymore.
I was just going to say, probably if anybody has done more work in this field, even tangentially, it would have to be Gene Roddenberry, because look how many things that he wrote in the early 1960s that have come to pass in one variety or another.
Well, even Jules Verne.
Oh, exactly. Look,
I mean, again, another person that saw the future, literally.
Paul Vonnegut. Exactly.
Yes. And you know, the one that keeps coming to mind, I told somebody the other day that they should definitely get the movie. What movie was it? Soylent Green. What was the name of that movie?
Hmm?
Soylent Green, the one that's, you know.
Vaguely, yeah.
Okay, that's a scary one, because it talks about the future where, you know, fresh fruit and fresh food and everything is definitely not available, we've gotten to the place where we've poisoned the planet and it's a frightening movie. It's even more so today than it was originally when it came out, because it could be true. We could be driving ourselves to that place. We are manipulating the vegetation that we eat to the point and we are almost to the point where the government will tell us what kind of seeds we can use and what kind of seeds we can't use. And
well,
there's something.
That, right. I mean.
Well, and as a gardener, a friend of mine has a 100-year-old tomato plant that hasn't been genetically engineered, and she is growing the seeds and she is hiding them away, and she's going to share them with other people who hopefully will share them with other people, because for some reason genetically engineered vegetables and fruits they say they're better for us, but I don't think that's true. And I'm just wondering, what are they trying to do? I mean, it's almost as though the government is trying to manipulate our own physiology so that it will either adapt or not adapt to certain areas and certain things. Our climate is absolutely changing. There's something going on there. I mean, as a gardener, I can tell you my plants don't have the faintest idea when to bloom and when to not bloom.
I would imagine.
And it's...
And, I think and, and you, there's such a interconnectivity of all of these things, all of these different paranormal or fringe topics, that to one degree or another, you're almost, we as a people, as a mass group, I think we're missing the big picture.
You think? Yeah, I would say so.
Well, like you said, that the Smithsonian has more than evidence of a race of giants. I would argue, you know, the existence of the creature we commonly call Sasquatch or Bigfoot, the existence of mer people, for example, or UFOs. I mean, all of these things are, they're so interconnected, and I don't think a lot of people really give them the time of day, because they sound so out there, but
yeah.
when you have people like Dr. Jeff Meldrum of Idaho State University, anthropologist, spending his time researching Sasquatch and writing essentially what amounts to a textbook, and there are so many things that we thought we knew about this planet, about our own ancestry, about how people came to be.
Yeah.
And then you find out that science was wrong.
Yeah.
Like, these early human ancestors died out 12,000 years ago as opposed to 120,000 years ago, for example. I mean,
yeah.
Doesn't that kind of alter the discussion?
Absolutely.
I mean,
well, look at, you know, we talk about UFOs and stuff like that, and they are a given. Everybody does accept the fact that they definitely are there. But look at the Vimanas. I mean, you know, these were UFOs that they were talking about in the Gita and in all of their texts, and that goes back 4,000, 5,000 years or further.
Oh, I'm sure. And I mean, I think there's so much interconnectivity here that the reason, maybe, if you want to look for, you know, religion, you know, teaches us to look for meaning or truth, whatever that might be. But I mean, if you want to try to search for a reason of that grand cosmic "why are we here" question, perhaps we're not the top of the food chain. You know, we're just the ones who've been able to adapt on land as best we can tell. There are so much of this planet is covered by water. What is to say that an early human ancestor didn't take to the water with climate change in the past, and that's why we have stories of mer people? I mean, that would stand completely to reason.
Absolutely.
I mean, it sounds fantastic, but when you break it down and when you look at it from a very clear point of view of A leads to B leads to C leads to D, it makes absolute logical sense. You know, you can't necessarily you don't necessarily have enough data to prove your hypothesis, but quite frankly, you don't have anything to disprove it either.
No. Well, you know, you take a look at all of the things that we consider strange that are out there, and Sasquatch, Bigfoot, Yeti, I mean, they all sound like they're really the same creature, just in different places in the country, in the world. A long time ago, you know, there were other things that we were sure were just, you know, a figment of our imaginations, and they've come true. So why should
the Bolin gorilla, for example, the giant panda? We thought them to be creatures of myth.
Well, the element of even unicorns. I mean, of course, the original, I mean, you know, we think, when I say unicorn, I think of a pretty big white horse with a horn on its head, and that's not exactly how the Bible described a unicorn. Unicorn was a pretty ugly thing here. But, I think that we have to go back and we have to reassess all of the fables, all of those fairy stories, or all of those old wives' tales that have been discounted because they were simply, you know, there was no scientific proof for them, and we've got to reassess their value and their reality and their applicability, because, frankly, so many of them work.
Well, absolutely, and I think if you look at, let's just take the argument of just general science. We've found in excavations of for example, of ancient Egypt, that the ancient peoples had developed essentially what amount to batteries.
Yeah.
Back, I don't know how many thousands of years before the Common Era, but then again, these are also the same people that show in their carvings and in their other writings hybrid creatures with animal heads and other human features. You look to South America, and you have more than one culture who tell us in one form or the other that their ancient societies, their ancient cities were built with the help of the men who came down from the sky.
Sky people, the gods, yeah.
And I mean, sure, some of that has been tinkered with and brought into the realm of popular fiction very nicely, but I think a lot of people, at least now, within the last 10 to 15 years, there are people who are in the entertainment business who are very, very ardent believers in all things paranormal.
Oh,
that,
yeah. Well,
I think a lot of people they see it as an entertaining film, but they don't bother to look beyond that.
Well, yeah. And have you, you know, the origin of the Kachina dolls, right?
Sounds very familiar. I can't place it off my head.
The Native American tribe that creates them says that they created the Kachina dolls when the sky people were here and they left. They said, "We'll be back," and so they created the Kachina dolls in the image
right.
of their
uh-huh.
gods, so that people would recognize their gods when their gods came back.
Right. Okay, that sounds, yeah.
So, and sky people, the gods. I mean, just about every ancient culture speaks of them. It's not like it's, just one place.
Well, exactly. But, I mean, like I said, there's so much that goes on now, especially in the entertainment world, that I think so many people are unaware of or just consider it a good imaginative fiction. A lot of people don't realize that, for example, when Dan Aykroyd wrote the original Ghostbusters, first of all, he's a benefactor of the Mutual UFO Network, as am I. He's a very, very serious student of the UFO subject. And almost everything, all of the technical dialogue that appears in the first Ghostbusters film is scientifically relevant, because parapsychology was taught in universities up to that point in time. And a lot of people don't necessarily know that. A more recent example, and I frankly love this one for obvious reasons, is the most recent Indiana Jones film, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah.
Have you seen it by any chance?
Oh, two or three times, yeah.
I love it because this character that we've known for, at that point, about 30 years, you know that throughout the course of the series that Indiana Jones was involved in government work, that he was a member of the military, etc.
Yeah.
And this last film takes place in the middle to late part of the 50s, and he gets questioned by FBI, your typical 50s G-man kind of a character. And General pulls him aside and says, do you have any idea what he's done, what he's seen? And they make reference specifically to Roswell. And you've got Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones sitting across the table from this FBI, presumably, this FBI character. And he says, oh, you mean that Air Force debacle back in 47? And I personally, Indiana Jones was saying everything that I thought and felt and believed. And just watching that film, I fell out of my chair laughing, because it's like, yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Because
no.
It's such a very interesting, it's an interesting thing that, I mean, you look at the entertainment world, and if you don't come away with the understanding that someone is trying to tell the masses something, then I don't know what else to say, because E.T., Close Encounters.
Oh, yeah.
Which one of the most
Close
prominent...
Close Encounters was one of my favorite movies.
Well, that's probably the most, to my knowledge, one of the most authentic sci-fi or UFO-related films of all time, because J. Allen Hynek, who was one of the most preeminent UFO researchers ever, I believe he was, the name in the world at that time, worked as consultant on that picture. So
Well, do you remember the scene in Close Encounters when they were on the road and all of the little vehicles came zapping on by them?
Mm-hmm.
That they say that what they did was they went back to every description of a UFO that had ever been made, and they made sure that they were all included in the film.
Yes. I remember hearing that actually from a gentleman who was a research associate of Alan Hynek's, and I've been told that from a number of elder statesmen in the UFO community as well. So I thought that was a real nice touch.
Oh, geez, they had so many really nice touches in that movie. I just, it's always been one of my favorites. And I think the one thing that they said in it that I think holds true is that at the very, very end where they decide to send the guy up into space with all of the other volunteers and somebody
right.
said, you know, he has to go and because he was invited. I think people who see UFOs are being given an invitation, not necessarily to go into space, but to start talking about the reality of the fact that this is something that is valid and out there, and we're not alone, and there is another community that is out there that we're supposed to be a part of if we ever get our heads out of our rear ends and start to realize that we need to change our ways in order to be acceptable to those, you know, those races that are out there. I think that in many cases this planet is one that has been sort of quarantined and put off limits for anybody to really, you know, touch down in because of our warlike nature.
Well,
you know?
Exactly. And that's a good point, because why? I mean, that opens up a wonderful argument of why 1947, why Roswell, New Mexico, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Because Roswell Army Airfield was, to my knowledge, that was the only facility with nuclear capability at that time. The Enola Gay that dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki originated from Roswell Army Airfield.
Wow.
So, and I mean, you know, the White Sands missile range, and that's all that area of the country. I mean, you look out into space, and a good number of things are visible of this planet from space. I would argue that you set off an atomic test somewhere in the southwestern portion of this country. I would argue somebody saw that from space, or at least it would be visible.
Yeah, and frankly, if I were an alien culture, I would look down and say, they're too primitive, we have to leave them alone. I mean, and they have big toys that they should not be playing with. That's the scary part of it. Nick, I have to close the show early tonight because I have another show I have to hop over to. But I do want to thank you so very much. It was just getting good, too.
When I get rambling, we should kind of go. we just get kind of wound up and we just kind of go.
That's true. I wish I had a longer show. But I would love to do this again and sooner rather than later, because I think that there's so much material to sort of put out there to people. There's so much information to give, and there's so much not being given that you know, just shows like this where two people can talk and ramble and put tidbits out there for people to, you know, and I encourage anybody who listens, check out what we've said. You know, play I Doubt It with everything that we've said. Go in, you know, go to Google, you know, check out the information, become an expert in the field, because if you don't, then if you are lied to and led astray and led down a pathway, it's your own fault. So,
well,
you know, just don't accept anything. Check everything out, because that's where the truth finally comes out. And that's what
mm-hmm.
Nick is definitely trying to do, and it's what Patrick tried to do, and in my own subtle way, that's what I'm trying to do. So Nick, thank you so much. You are always such a pleasure to have on air, and I so appreciate your taking the time out of your busy schedule to share some of your wisdom with us here tonight.
Hey, you know, just you've got my number, you want me back, just let me know. I'm more than happy to impart whatever it is that I have.
Well, I'm going to do some more research and come at you with some other stuff, too. So I thank you so much for being here tonight, and I so deeply appreciate, you know, all the wisdom that you have to share, and I appreciate all the research you're doing so I don't have to. So I will talk to you soon.
Sleep, and I'd much rather it be me than you.
I'll talk to you soon, Nick. Thanks again.
You take care, Barb.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And thank all of you so very much for listening, for tuning in, for being in the chat room, for sharing your wisdom and your knowledge with us. And I will look forward to seeing you on Friday. Friday, Jeannie and I will be on the air again for Nightlight Regular. And we look forward to seeing you, hearing from you, and sharing time and light with you then. Good night, everybody.